Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. According to what I've just been told, here's the podcast for the Early Morning Late Show. Enjoy our conversations. Good morning. It's 4 minutes after the hour, and it is Wednesday, although for some of us, it feels like Friday already, because I get the feeling that after work today, you're off for a day or two, maybe three or four. So I hope you have a great Thanksgiving weekend. We're getting it started today. We're going to bring Carmen LeBurge on in just a minute, and then we're going to wrap up the show today with Jonathan Den Hartog, a professor of history here at the University of Northwestern. And that is one smart guy. We're going to talk about some of the origins of Thanksgiving. So, all right, I was reading this morning, Anicia Proba. She died in AD 432. She was a Roman noblewoman and a Christian believer, and she was also a friend of Augustine. And she was asking Augustine if she was praying as she should. And Augustine wrote her a letter. And she said, Augustine said, the first principle is that before you know what to pray for and how to pray for it, you must become a particular kind of person. You must account yourself desolate in this world, however great the prosperity of your lot may be. The scales must have fallen from your eyes, and you must see clearly that no matter how great your earthly circumstances become, they can never bring you the lasting peace, happiness, and consolation that are found in Christ. Unless you have that clearly in view, your prayers may go wrong. And it's one of the main themes of Augustine's theology when applied to prayer is we must see that our heart's loves are disordered. They're out of order. Things we ought to love third or fourth are first in our hearts. God, whom we should love supremely, is someone we may acknowledge, but whose favor and presence is not existentially as important to us as prosperity, success, status, love, and pleasure. So, for example, if we look to our financial prosperity as our main source of safety and confidence in life, then when our wealth is in grave jeopardy, we'll cry out to God for help, but our prayers will be little more than worrying in God's direction. Chew on that one this morning. Anyway, we're very grateful that you're listening. We're very grateful that you're supporters of Faith Radio. We just absolutely love our listeners, and we love God's Word, and we want to get the day started with Carmen LeBurge. She's already on our studio line. It is 7 minutes after the hour. Reconnect with Carmen is up next. Good morning. It's 8 minutes after the hour. Carmen LeBurge on our studio line. You might connect with her at reconnectwithcarmen.com. I don't know if that sentence made a lot of sense at this time of the morning, but I think you get the idea. Carmen, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Bill.
All right. How about this, just for a little starter tease? American couples spend 5.5 days a year deciding what to eat.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
That's kind of shocking. So every time we get something, some kind of feedback like this, it's like related to, how long it takes you to pick out your clothes every day,
right,
or how much time we spend deciding what to eat. I suppose that the lesson for those of us living in a culture like ours is that there's both a paralysis that comes by having so many choices, but also a recognition that we are incredibly blessed.
Oh my!
Now,
yeah,
we're just overwhelmingly blessed. Like, right, if I have more than one pair of jeans to put on in the morning, I have a choice to make.
Right,
and in that choice, my blessedness is revealed.
Right. So it says couples spend an average of 132 hours a year trying to figure out what to eat. What do you want? What do you think we should? Where do you want to go? And so we're making all these, spending all this time. And I think, boy, we live in abundance. And then I don't know what the advertising budget is every year in this country for advertising food and beverage. I think it's in excess of $50 billion is spent advertising food and drink, encouraging us to eat a certain product.
So stunning. It is stunning. And I suppose that because I'm the person who cooks maybe 99% of the meals in our home, pretty much the people in my family are eating what is put on the table. And so I suppose I'm the one making the vast majority of those decisions. I'm not paralyzed by this issue.
Okay. But I just want to use this as a segue into an understanding of how abundant we have it in this country. Yet there are still so many in this country that go to bed hungry at night. So it is the week of Thanksgiving. It's a time for gratitude. There's many physical and spiritual blessings which we need to be thankful for.
Yeah, and I think that you have lifted up one of the great responsibilities for Christians in the culture today, which is to recognize that although many people in the culture are living in great abundance and with an endless number of choices related to what they're going to eat and who's going to prepare that and where they're going to eat, there are a staggering number of people in our country, particularly those who are elderly and those who are children, who do not have the access to the kinds of healthy food that they need in order for them to, for kids to grow and for the elderly to maintain, a healthy weight. And so I just think that one of the things we should all be very, very mindful of in our abundance, as we are counting our blessings and celebrating the abundance and harvest of our own tables and our lives, that with that comes a great responsibility to be sure that others in our own communities who, you know, we see at the grocery store, we see them at the Dollar General, we see them struggling to make decisions about how they're going to, divide up the few pennies that they have. And mm-hmm. so we absolutely need to be aware of that. And we just need to step in and buy their groceries. Like, I don't think that there's, if a person has in their basket what they want and what they've chosen, to extend to them the blessing of paying partially for that or for all of that can be a great gift. And so let me just encourage people to do that today. It's Wednesday. Tomorrow is Thanksgiving. Buy an extra turkey and just drop it off at someone's house who, you know they're struggling. We know who our neighbors are, whose kids are going to school in the same clothes every day. I mean, like, we are aware of those things. And so those are the families that we really need to be intentional about reaching out to today.
Mm-hmm. So how do we remain thankful, Carmen, in a year kind of like the year we've had, which has had lots of natural disasters? There's been painful shootings like in Las Vegas and Charlottesville. I mean, there was Sutherland Springs. I mean, this can be very heavy on our hearts and for a good reason.
Oh, so the times that we live in are heavy, and I think that, Bill, part of the challenge that we face is our awareness of everything that's happening everywhere all the time. And so let me encourage people to focus on what's going on in your own home and in your own heart for the next few days. Maybe take a little sabbatical from some of that social media. And then also just recognize that God is sovereign. I know that seems trite, but for Christians, we absolutely must recognize that no matter what the circumstances are, no matter the, how does Paul say it? No matter the conditions under which I'm living, like I count it all a blessing. Like I recognize, that I am blessed. I'm blessed to know who God is. I'm blessed to know his redemptive plan. I'm blessed to be possessed of the Holy Spirit. So regardless of the circumstances of this particular moment, even if I'm in prison, even if people are doing harm to me or harm to others whom I love, the reality is, as a Christian, I recognize that this is not my home. And even this physical body, though it be wasting away, I'm being prepared right now inside by one degree of glory to another for an eternal hope and blessing. And that's not to say we're pie in the sky people, like, right. We are also, there's pie right now people. And so I don't want this to come off as something that is simply future oriented, because in the context of the world we live in now, we are supposed to be the ambassadors of blessing.
Indeed. Carmen, let me take a break. And when I come back, I want to ask you about the way the Thanksgiving table can be maybe changing for some this year. Maybe there's an empty chair, or maybe there are a couple of new chairs added. And let's talk about that when I come back. It's 15 minutes after the hour. Good morning. So glad you're with us. Be back with Carmen in a minute. Good morning. It's 18 minutes after the hour. Carmen LaBurge is my guest. And Carmen, as we're looking at the holidays, I always think they're like putting a big magnifying glass on your life. Everything looks real big all of a sudden. And for those who have maybe gone through a loss or an addition this year, it might be sad for some, happy for others. But the changing dynamics at the Thanksgiving table, talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that the anxiety that comes with sitting down at table together with people, either with whom we have some sort of genetic relation but don't necessarily spend a whole lot of time with over the course of a year, that can be stressful for people. It can be stressful to have kids return from college with all kinds of new ideas and different perspectives on things, and we want them to be at home again at home, and yet they are very, very different people than when they left even just a few months ago. The stress is related to the holidays. People should not underestimate. And I think that for Christians, we need to be very, very mindful that the conversations that can be had around the table tomorrow, and not just around the table, but as you're preparing for the meal, as, you know, the guys are out back frying the turkey, or, you know, whatever it is that's going on at your house in preparation for the time together, each and every one of those encounters is an opportunity for us to listen with humility to what's going on in the life of another person. Mm-hmm. I know that for our family, the constellation of individuals around that table any given year is different. It just is. And the number goes up and down based on who can travel and who needs to be elsewhere. As the family grows and kids get married, they've got other in-laws and people to deal with, and particularly families who also have divorce in their past. There can be a multiplicity of households that that young adults feel responsible to, you know, eat four Thanksgiving meals. Are you kidding me? I mean, that's just absurd.
Not in my world.
I think as Christian parents and adults and grandparents, we need to recognize with humility that this is not just it's not essential to eat the Thanksgiving meal on Thanksgiving. You can spread this out over the 4-day holiday, or 5 days, or you can have the Thanksgiving meal, you know, on the following Sunday, if that's what works for your family. Let's be people who extend grace in the midst of Thanksgiving. But you point out a really important thing, Bill, when you talk about, the possibility that there's an empty chair this year at the Thanksgiving table. I remember, it's been a long time ago now, 1984, that my dad died. I was in high school. And that next Thanksgiving, there is a really obvious empty chair at the head of the table. It is, and it's a gut punch. It doesn't, it had been months since he died. But you literally, like, you don't know what to do as a kid in that circumstance. And my mom was still, deeply, deeply grieving. And so I want people to recognize that the empty chair at the table tomorrow that's vacated by a loved one who was there last year, that is absolutely an opportunity for you to talk openly about the reality of life and death, about the reality of, what we're doing right now as the people of God in the world, blessed to know him and blessed to have a seat saved for us in heaven. That empty chair here at your Thanksgiving table is a reminder that that person is sitting in a chair somewhere for all eternity. And are they sitting at a chair at the banquet feast of the Lamb? Like, that's obviously the hope we're holding out for every individual. But we got to have those conversations now to ensure that the chairs that are empty at the banquet feast of the Lamb right now in heaven are filled at some point by the people who are around our table tomorrow. Like, no, that's part of our spiritual obligation.
Yeah. Amen to all of that. And then to have a sense of urgency as well, to be open and sharing about your faith is probably another good reminder for our listeners.
It is, and I know that, you know, people have been told, you know, there's subjects that you're supposed to avoid mm-hmm. when you are sitting down at the holiday table. You know, I pretty much everything's politicized now. I don't think we should be politicizing our Thanksgiving Day tables. But the reality is, you know, football has now become politicized, and people are still going to watch football on Thanksgiving Day,
mm-hmm.
Or some of them will, or maybe some of them will choose not to. And so I don't think to spiritualize what's happening at Thanksgiving is a problem at all. It started as a spiritual holiday. I think that's one of the things you're going to talk with your upcoming guest about. You know, this really did start as a holiday where Americans bowed the knee to God and said, you know, thank you. Thank you for the gift of the harvest. Thank you for the freedoms of this land. Thank you for the opportunity to be people who are productive and enjoy the benefits of our own production. There's all kinds of blessings to count at Thanksgiving that go way beyond just the material.
Mm-hmm. Carmen, I wanted to, just with a few minutes left, I actually wanted to talk to you about an article David Brooks wrote on what he called the siege mentality problem. There's a lot of conservative evangelicals in Alabama that are still supporting Roy Moore. And there's also many evangelicals around the country who spent the last couple of years embracing Donald Trump. So is there what's going on with all this with among evangelicals?
All right. Well, let's talk about first, let's define siege mentality, because I think that that's an important thing for people to understand as we jump into this conversation.
Yeah, you'll have
so
to do it.
When David Brooks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'll do it. I'll do it really quick. So when David Brooks says we have a siege mentality problem, what he's talking about is, and this is not just evangelical Christians in America who have a siege mentality problem. This is actually on all sides of the conversation. A siege mentality starts with a sense that we are victims, and it grows into sort of a general pessimism about the status of things and the direction things are headed. So obviously, biblical Christians would say, well, yeah, there is an enemy, and the enemy is strong. But we also recognize, I mean, if we're honest about our biblical theology, the enemy is not growing stronger. And we also know the victor and that the victory has been won. So part of the problem with the siege mentality when it's adopted by Christians is that it's unfaithful to who God is and to the biblical narrative. So David Brooks does not point that out. He doesn't come right out and say, hey, look, this apocalyptic fear that Christians are fomenting in the culture and fanning the flame of is unrighteous. Like, yes, the end is coming, but Jesus is coming with the end. Like, get with it, people, is what I think he should have said. He was much more kind than that.
Yeah.
But the reason the siege mentality works in terms of using people's fears against them is it enables us to feel superior to everybody else in the culture. And so if I, you know, if I am the righteous martyr, if I am the one who knows the truth and all those people out there, you know, are living a lie and they're a bunch of liars and, you know, it's an us versus them mentality and there's a culture war going on, well, that actually abandons the biblical idea that we are the ambassadors of the kingdom of heaven in the midst of the kingdoms of this world. It's our job to be culture makers here and now. So we are without excuse. If we're the people complaining about the culture that we are in, we have failed in our own responsibility as Christ's ambassadors to this generation. Like, this is our time. This is our place. This is the country where God sent us. Like, it's time for Christians to wake up, get over the siege mentality, recognize that we are the ones who have the victory, be with Job and say, I know that my Redeemer lives, and one day he's going to walk upon the earth. In the meantime, I'm a steward and a manager, and I have responsibilities for everything that God has put within my reach, and I'm supposed to be a bright, shiny light, even if my generation seems particularly dark.
Wow. Well said, Carmen. Thank you so much. Just one other quick question. Do you have a David Cassidy lunch pail?
I do not. I will just go ahead and confess that we were not TV people.
Okay. All right. I'm not going to hold that against you. Well, thanks so much and have a wonderful Thanksgiving. And I'll talk to you again hopefully next week.
Fantastic.
All right. Thanks, Carmen. 27 minutes after the hour, we'll take a very short break and then head to Ken Davis and a little lighten up. It is half past the hour. Good morning. It is Wednesday, and we all know what tomorrow is. So you are looking at a short work week for many, which is nice. And it's going to be great to get together with the family tomorrow and have a meal. Hopefully that's the plan. We're going to take a little break for news. Then we'll come back. Dr. Ken Kaiser will be with us in about 10 minutes.
Not just information. It's transformation.
So much of today's news is negative and it doesn't put your focus in the right place. And Faith Radio, even if it might be something negative, the spin is that we ultimately trust God and that He is in control. And it helps us to pray for those places that are struggling versus being focused on the negative. It will change your focus just to get your day started on the right directions.
Highlighting real hope every day. Faith Radio.
Our $20 trillion debt should cause us grave concern. And yes, I'm talking to those of us who call ourselves Christian. This is Jim Garlow. Our nation follows a largely capitalist system which has been undermined by socialistic welfare programs. And now we find ourselves on the brink of national bankruptcy, created in part by a crony system where government picks winners and losers by granting contracts, manipulating laws, and bailing out failing businesses. It undermines natural checks and balances within a free market that makes it work. Government has a role in overseeing business and enforcing criminal laws, but for that to work, it must remain fair and neutral, not forced and coerced. What we need is an opportunity for a distinctly Judeo-Christian framework and a government that will follow its constitutional limitations to allow citizens to be free to create in the image of God. There's more at jimgarlow.com.
Good morning. That should wake you up. That is the bagpipe music that belongs to Dr. Ken Kaiser, who has strolled in his casual Carleton College sweatshirt today. A little conflict of interest there, Kent?
Well, I don't know. I don't think there's much competition between the two, honestly. It's my alma mater.
Yeah, we know that. We know that. Well, you've got a busy day planned. You're going to get in the car and head up north to go be with your folks.
Yep, that's right. Eat a lot of food, I'm sure.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming in. You probably didn't have to get up early and come in this morning, but you did anyway. And that's the kind of commitment I'm looking for on this team.
All right.
So, thank you. I was talking to Carmen LaBerge just before you came on, and I wanted to sort of bring up the siege mentality problem, because I knew it was a subject you'd want to discuss as well. And so I would like to get some of your input on that.
Well, there is this idea that when Christians are under siege, they just automatically sort of, you know, close ranks and then defend anybody who's in those ranks. Mm-hmm. And we do have that kind of going on in this election in Alabama with Roy Moore. I think Christians have felt under siege for a long time. It's in all aspects of life, practically. And you feel this, that everybody's always attacking you. And so all of a sudden it becomes like all attacks on any Christian. You kind of dismiss them and you sort of default to, well, these attacks are unreasonable. And I think that that's especially what's going on with right now in Alabama with Roy Moore. I think it's also the kind of thing that was going on even last year with President Trump's election. I think that people still to this day keep asking the questions, how could so many evangelical Christians support President Trump and so on? Because, you know, what 80% or more did. And it is kind of easy to see when you're a Christian, you're being told that your worldview is wrong at every single turn mm-hmm. to, you know, just defend whoever is defending you. And that's what Trump did. And in this case in Alabama, we've got our Roy Moore, who comes from a Christian background. And so Christians feel like he's with them. And so they feel like if he's under siege, so are they. So that's kind of what's going on, I think.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested, Kent, in getting your take on the way the rules will apply across the board when somebody like Charlie Rose has a couple of accusations against him and he has admitted to inappropriate behavior. And boy, he has been obliterated now. He's off the show. His PBS show is canceled. Now, will these rules apply across the board?
No. And I think that the reason is, like, Charlie Rose is old. They can get him off the stage. And they're not really losing much. I mean, he probably wasn't that far from retirement in the first place. So that's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they can use him as an example and say, oh, look, we got rid of Charlie Rose right away. Meanwhile, if we look at, say, Al Franken, the senator from Minnesota, who's now been accused of some wrongdoing, boy, they like that guy so much for being in the Senate. And you see there was a big list of women who've worked for him in the past that they actually put out a list of people who support him. Now, that's got to have a chilling effect on anybody who wants to stand up and say, he did something bad to me, too. And they're going to defend, just as they did with President Clinton back in the 90s, because he has the right ideology, the right political view. And to be very specific, the feminists, feminist liberals, supported Clinton, I think primarily because he was for abortion,
mm-hmm.
you know, and if you look at Franken, it's the same kind of thing. The liberals are going to look at him and say, oh, the things that he did were kind of bad, but, you know, we really like his point of view and we really like how he votes and we really like his leadership or whatever they want to call it in the Senate. And so then they're not going to, they ultimately would just pay lip service to how bad the things he did were and how embarrassed they are about him, but ultimately nothing will happen. And even if it did, by the way, with Al Franken, there's a Democratic governor in Minnesota who's extremely liberal, who would no doubt appoint another who would be as liberal or worse than Franken if Franken were to step down.
But Ken, as we hear about Charlie Rose, we're hearing about accusations that have been made against Charlie, but we have actually lots of photos of Al.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Seem in compromising situations, and yet Charlie's gone and Al's still hanging in there.
Yeah, well, again, Charlie Rose is older. I think that there were credible allegations. I mean, that's what it comes down to, too, is sort of like how many of them there are and how likely they sound. And, you know, I don't know. Personally, when I heard that Al Franken had done these things, I wasn't shocked or something. I've always thought the guy came across as creepy. And I know other people have thought that too, and so who's surprised? I'm sure not, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard the same thing about Weinstein. I've heard people who actually knew the guy who thought he was creepy too. And so, you know, when these allegations come forth, I mean, there's some people, if an allegation comes up, you're kind of like, nah, that can't be. But nobody's saying, nah, that can't be about Al Franken or Weinstein, and probably nobody was saying can't be about Charlie Rose, but... you know, they're in different positions. And so, you know, Al Franken's in a position where liberals like him being there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's unlikely that they're going to really do anything to get him out.
Mm-hmm. You know, there was that Carpenter song, "We've Only Just Begun." I think every time I open up the internet and go to a news page, there's another name or another person in trouble. I think this is probably going to continue for a while.
Well, it probably will, and I think there's different levels of it too, obviously, and that's a thing that, you know, people are, I think, trying to be discerning. It's one thing to be sexually harassed verbally or something like that, and a totally different thing to be touched, and we're seeing different levels of even that, and yet, see, the thing is, you go back to the past, and it's not that long ago, like 20 years ago or whatever, when Bill Clinton was facing charges of inappropriate behavior, and the liberals pushed it under the rug and you know, when Juanita Broderick said that she was raped and Paula Jones said she was assaulted and others did too. Mm-hmm. And they just swept it under the rug. So the liberals are in a very tough position because they're supposedly all for women's empowerment, women's rights and so on. And yet they're caught in the position of defending somebody who's done wrong things. And then Republicans are not the ones who have been known as defenders of women. And so, you know, yet they're in a tough position because, you know, because of that reputation of supposedly being anti-woman, then they're in a tough position, too, if any of these allegations come up against any of their folks.
Mm-hmm. I do find it interesting now there's a discussion about what kind of environment or culture should exist. And I think of the Mike Pence principle, which is, boy, I'm not really alone in a room with a woman when my wife is not present. And I know they made fun of him for that, but I think that we might be headed in a direction which has more restraints from a business standpoint and maybe a government standpoint. What's acceptable? I mean, if a company has a toga party, should you be surprised that there might be some inappropriate things that go on?
Well, yeah, you got to question
the whole. I'm not knocking toga parties, just so you know.
No, I think that there's something to be said for the Pence rule. I mean, I know that I know many people, including myself. You know, we don't have closed door meetings.
Okay.
And, you know, I would never have a closed door meeting with a female student. And we have glass doors, in fact, on our offices here mm-hmm. in our building. And I think that's by design, obviously. And I think it's a good thing. But, yeah, I think it's awkward because if you think about people going into the workforce, you are going to have to nowadays, you're not going to be able to work in a unisex environment. You're not going to work with, if you're a woman, you're not going to work with all women. If you're a man, you're not going to work with all men.
Mm-hmm.
And so we do have this, you know, in a workplace, how do you deal with one-on-one meetings and things like that? And I think Mike Pence's rule is probably a good one, that you either don't have those meetings, like he says, or you make it so that there is effectively somebody else in the room by leaving the door open and having your meeting in a rather public place.
Mm-hmm. You can still have a meeting with a member of the opposite sex with the door open and an assistant outside the door.
That's
and
right.
Then that doesn't necessitate what's going on in your heart. You could be having all kinds of lustful thoughts and everything else, and you could be far down the road wanting to have some other possible affair.
So, right. Well, part of the problem, too, is that it's not in the eye of the person who's being accused at this point.
Right.
Nowadays, it's in the eye of the accuser. And so you don't want to have any sign of impropriety.
Right.
That's the problem. And
right.
So Mike Pence is right about that because it's not, if you even had a pure heart in your meeting, it's the accuser who has sort of the upper hand in a way in the dialogue.
Right.
That's
right.
The problem.
Yeah. All right, Kent, let me take a break. When we come back, more with Dr. Kent Kaiser. It's 13 minutes until the top of the hour. Happy Wednesday.
Keeps coming much too much, but I'll make it. Day at a time.
Good morning. 11 minutes until the top of the hour. Dr. Kent Kaiser is in studio. Kent, what is your favorite pie?
Well, I play the bagpipe, so it's shepherd's pie. But if you're asking me about a dessert pie, then I like pretty much all of them. But my favorite is probably raspberry pie.
Raspberry pie.
Yeah.
That feels like a North Shore thing.
It is. I like to go out in the woods and get. I don't like to pick raspberries. They're tedious. I like to pick blueberries, but I love to eat raspberry pie.
Yeah, they're
more
awesome.
More than I like blueberry pie. Although I love blueberry pie too, but I love to make pies.
Do you really?
They're so easy.
Oh, okay.
And berry pies are so easy.
And you make the homemade crust yourself?
Used to.
Used to, yeah.
But, you know, Pillsbury Doughboy makes
they do
such
a nice
really
job,
good
don't
ones.
They? No, just
yeah,
go
they
to
do.
The store.
Yeah.
All right. because of the impending holiday, let's talk about why we should still celebrate the pilgrims.
Well, no, it's interesting that the pilgrims are so assailed and maligned in today's world. You know, people make it sound like they were some kind of that they had some kind of intent to come to the new world and murder Indians or massacre right. Indians or something. You know, take them out, which was so far from the truth. When the pilgrims first came, they got along with the Indians really well, like the first Thanksgiving story would tell us. Now, the first Thanksgiving story is a little bit different from what would have really happened back in the day. When the pilgrims first came in 1620, they got here a little bit late in the year, and so they really didn't have time to get any crops going. So a lot of people starved that first winter. Mm-hmm. And so there's no way they would have had like what we would think of as Thanksgiving that first year. And then for the subsequent couple of years, they actually had a communal system for farming. Where, you know how that works. So everybody's supposed to work, and then everybody benefits from mm-hmm. the work. Well, of course, because nobody was particularly beholden to the work that they put in, you know, and nobody was accountable, they starved for the next couple of years with this communal system. And then they finally divided up the plots into individual family plots, and all of a sudden there was abundance. So it was about 1623 that they would have had perhaps a Thanksgiving feast of some kind. So some will dispute that, and well, it's probably true that they would have had different times of the year or whatever when they were celebrating. I mean, we all know that. I remember when I was a kid, you know, you had a big celebration in July when the potatoes and peas were ready, right? And then another one when the corn was ready mm-hmm. or something like that. So it might have looked a little bit different than today. And the foods back then would have been really different. They were living in a pretty tough world, you know, in the wilderness in New England. And so the foods would have been really different. Surely they could have had wild turkey, which, by the way, isn't anything even close to a tame turkey. They're kind of nasty. The drumsticks have like these spurs in them. They're hard, very difficult to eat. But then in addition to that, they probably would have had shellfish because there they were on the ocean. And so they would have had some really kind of different foods than what we envision for Thanksgiving today. But it is interesting, like there's a little economics lesson in those first few years of the pilgrims being here and showing that communism does not work.
Yeah, it's not until there was a little bit of individual families getting their own plot of land and farming themselves.
Yeah, and it's well documented that all of a sudden they had this abundance when they were all responsible for taking care of their families. But in the meantime, unfortunately, many people died of starvation in those mm-hmm. in those first couple of years. Now, the first year, like I say, they got here so late and the weather was harsh in New England. And,
mm-hmm. So the yeah. early Thanksgiving menus, Kent, for your information, from what I've researched, was possibly wild goose or duck.
That makes sense.
Wild turkey, deer, flint corn, fish, shellfish, and eels. Yum, yum.
yeah, I'm sure we're all putting eels out on the table tomorrow.
Well, yeah. And, of course, the modern Thanksgiving menu is turkey, mashed potatoes, stuffing, cranberry sauce, gravy, and corn. Boy, doesn't that just make you hungry just talking about it?
Kind of.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's just talk a little bit about the budget before we wrap up our time together.
Well, it looks like the Congress is going to try to get a budget through here before the end of the year and give us all a Christmas present because it would include a big tax cut. But there are some stumbling blocks potentially in the way of that happening, and one of them is the DREAM Act. The Democrats want to tie the DREAM Act to the budget, and by doing so, they could tick off enough conservative Republicans that it wouldn't pass, and in order to pass the budget, they need Democratic and Republican votes. There's going to be Republicans who vote against any budget, and there's going to be Democrats who are going to vote against any. So it has to be a collaborative effort, but that's one big stumbling block that might be there. And because Paul Ryan, the Republican leader in the House, is saying that they want to pass a clean DREAM Act after the new year, because President Trump has extended the time for those immigrants to be here until March. So mm-hmm. that immigration issue doesn't really need to be addressed until after the new year. But the Democrats really want it before that.
Mm-hmm. Will the Democrats give the president any pat on the back for just the general direction of the economy and unemployment being low?
No way.
Why?
Well, I mean, they don't want him to look good. In fact, isn't it interesting how little focus there's been on the economy? Here we are I remember one time there was a guy who wrote, I can't remember who it was, he wrote a book about Dow 25,000, and people laughed. You know, here we are on the brink of hitting 25,000 with the Dow today, and you're not hearing a peep about it. You know, it's crazy. I mean, there's been like some $5 or $6 billion added to the economy mm-hmm. since Trump took office, mm-hmm. which is phenomenal. The growth rates, I saw a map of growth rates. Now, Minnesota happened to be a little bit low, but most states, some of the states are experiencing like 6% growth rates right now in their gross domestic product. And so, I mean, wages are going up more for people with blue collar and labor jobs right now, like going up by something like 6 to 10% this mm-hmm. past year, as compared with professionals, which are going up maybe only 1% yeah. or something like that. So the economy is not only booming, but it's getting good for the people at the lowest levels of the economy and the people who have needed, who have suffered the most over the last 8 years of Obama, especially. And then where the growth was in things like mining. And mm-hmm. all of a sudden you have states like North Dakota, Texas, West Virginia, which their economies are suddenly booming and people are doing better. And you're not hearing a word about that.
Right.
You know.
And with 1.8 million people off food stamps, that's a nice little improvement as well.
Well, and I'm sure that these things will come up, but not until Trump's reelection campaign.
Yeah, probably so. Mm-hmm. Kent, thank you so much. Have a great and blessed Thanksgiving, and I'll see you next week.
Thanks for having me on.
All right, you bet. It is 4 minutes until the top of the hour. We'll take a short break and be back. Thank you so much to Carmen LaBurge and Dr. Kent Kaiser. What a great first hour we had. If you are in no hurry to go anywhere, that makes me very happy. Get another cup of coffee. And let's get started with hour two just around the corner. Straight ahead, we've got Bill English from BibleandBusiness.com. He is out in the green room right now shuffling through his notes, looking organized, which is encouraging to me. And then Dr. Jonathan Den Hartog, professor of history here at the University of Northwestern, is going to come in and give us the big history lesson on Thanksgiving. So that will be fascinating and a good conversation around the table tomorrow. Be back in just a minute. Thanks for listening to the Early Morning Late Show podcast. These conversations are available because of your prayerful and financial support. Make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. To avoid missing future editions of the Early Morning Late Show, subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend and grow the impact of the Early Morning Late Show.